Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Andre Debuse III is the author of the critically acclaimed novel House of Sand and Fog and the memoir Townie. In his new collection of novellas, Dirty Love, he tells stories of love tainted and gone wrong. A bartender cheats on his pregnant wife. A program manager finds out his wife is having an affair. And in the title story, a young woman takes refuge with her great uncle after a picture of her performing sexual acts goes online. Again, the new book is Dirty Love, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Andre Debuse III to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. As always, we love talking to you.
Well, Joe, thank you for having me. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you. What brought you down this road, do you think? These are novellas, they're stories, but they certainly are ultimately linked.
I would say abject fear, pain, longing, regret, and the haunted memories of my youth.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, all the good stuff. And all that's true, and it's probably not true. You know, you and I have talked about this before, but for me, the writing of fiction is this descent into the dream world, and the dream world is full of surprises, right? And then they're not a surprise. You know, you see something, and you think, oh, well, that would make sense. That came out of me. You know, I've been married for 25 years, and I'm seeing a lot of our friends' marriages are falling apart after 25, 30 years, and kind of haunted by that on a personal level. And I think I'm looking harder at just how difficult it is and challenging it is to love someone well and be loved well.
And there's that aspect to it, of course, and then there's also the aspect of having children at that age as well.
Right.
And
right.
What impact that has on the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, in my own view is that nothing's better than having a child, but nothing's harder on the couple that had them in some ways, although in other ways it gives you a bond you wouldn't have had otherwise. Yeah, it's a rich stew, man. I mean, I can see where some writers would only write about family and domestic stories for their whole artistic lives because there's so much material to mine there.
Did you always set out to have this be separate?
Novellas. No, what's strange is they came over a long period of time. The oldest one is The Bartender, which I published in 1999, and that was the phoenix that rose from the ashes of a novel that failed. Hmm. I wanted to write about a certain kind of predator. I went back in time to see who his father and mother were, and the father became this carousing, self-deceitful, drinking, cheating poet wannabe bartender, and he had far more life than the predator I wanted to write about. So I wrote that and then spent 5 years writing my novel, The Garden of the Last Days. And then came Marla, this lonely woman working in a bank, looking for love and having a hard time finding it. She was going to be my predator's first victim. And when I got into her point of view, she was so much more alive than the predator. I ended up ditching the predator again and just going with Marla. You know, if I've learned nothing over the years writing fiction, I've learned that just because you, the writer, want to write about A, doesn't mean A wants to be written about by you. That along the way, you find something that has more life or more truth or more energy, and you really have to go with that, whether you want to or not.
I don't want to get all psychological on you. Mm. However, I do wonder if coming out of writing a memoir, does it get you thinking about these issues? And as you say, a lot of it is a surprise. However, maturity and time allow you to look back on those. Does it focus you a little bit more to be able to connect the dots in a fictional sense?
It's interesting you say that. I think it did, because I came back to the writing of fiction after writing my memoir Townie with a renewed joy of sinking into the private life of another human being. You know, it really felt like slipping into a hot bath after getting bruised in a street fight. Right. It was so much more enjoyable for me to write about other people than myself. Even though I'm glad I wrote my memoir, it was really lovely to become other people again. And galvanizing, you're right. There's a level of concentration you have to have if you're trying to write honestly from the point of view of other people without injecting your own views or your own experience. I try not to do that. But as you say, or as you suggest, the writer is always revealing him or herself in their fiction. And I know I'm all through this book. Although I don't know exactly where.
But it seems to be a mature, or perhaps more mature, view in the sense of, in reading this, it doesn't seem like something you'd write in your 20s.
Yeah, it's an older writer's book. Yeah, thank you for saying that. I think so. And, you know, one of the things I think I'm proud of, and I use that word sparingly because It's not a feeling I have very often after finishing a book. There's always this haunting sense that a better writer would have done better, but it's the best I can do.
Mm.
And I think that's fairly normal for a lot of writers. But I do like that there's no physical violence in this book. It's the first book of fiction I've written where physical violence doesn't happen. There's the threat of it. There's the sense that it may happen. And it's strange, you know, by writing about, you know, the last book being Townie, by having written about the real violence I experienced both as a victim and a perpetrator as a young man, by writing directly about the violence of my own life, I somehow freed myself to not have to write about it in the next work of fiction, which is interesting to me. But it does make it feel more mature to me.
In writing these stories, as you say, some of them have start dates that go back a ways. So to revisit them and to look at them with a more mature eye, and once you have the pieces, if you will, of starting to work with them, does that make it any more pleasurable in the sense of even more artistic than starting from scratch?
Yeah, I think so. Well, for me, you're nailing the most essential joy of writing for me is revision. And it's an important part of the process. Look, I enjoy all aspects of writing. Hemingway called it the sweet labor. And it is a very sweet labor to write those original sentences in that white space. I forget who said this, a woman writer whose work I respect. She said, if a novel is a steel bridge over a river, in those first drafts, you're actually creating the iron with which to make the steel bridge.
Mm.
And I love once I have that bridge over the river, and I'm really just messing with that design, and it's deeply pleasurable. And those are the sessions I can do 10, 12 hours a day with. When I'm building the iron from scratch, or to mix metaphors, putting the clay on the table, I can't work more than 2 or 3 hours. My level of concentration starts to fade after that.
In the stories that you tell in this book, there is a, as you say, there isn't that, the physical violence, but there is a menace always there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, huh? You know, I think you especially feel it. Well, no, it's kind of all through there. Especially, I think, in the first story, listen carefully as our options have changed. You've got a couple in their mid-50s, 25 years of marriage. She strays and starts to have an affair with a man she met at the gym. The main character, Mark Welch, hires a detective who films just what Mark fears most. And then the menace is really after it's been discovered, right? We don't know how Mark's going to continue to melt down. Is he going to actually pick up that lead pipe in the garage and use it?
Right.
And really his meltdown seems to be far more internal, self-destructive, but it seems to lead to an insight that maybe she wasn't such the bad guy that he thought she was. That maybe he's got his own flaws, and maybe he's got a hand in her drifting away from him a little bit.
There's certainly, and I think in any kind of domestic situation, there is, okay, well, it's this guy's fault, it's this woman's fault, and you take you balance that very nicely in all these stories.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear you say that, because I just don't believe in the villain. I don't even believe in protagonists and antagonists. I just do not believe anybody is above anyone else. I think we are all capable of the most base behavior, and we're all capable of the most saintly, godly behavior. I love this line from Tom Waits from his song Heart Attack and Vine. There is no devil, there's just God when he's drunk. You know, and that's blasphemy to some ears, but man, I just think that we all are born full of light and love, and we screw it up. And then we're always working our way back to where we began, which was more pure than we'll ever be again.
I was in bed reading this book. My wife is next to me reading her book. And I was, I made kind of a sigh. And she said, what is it? And I said, I don't know how comfortable I would be if you wrote this. And I'm wondering of examining your marriage and thinking about it, does it, because it has to come up, doesn't it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, my wife is just so secure in so many ways. It's shocking. Yeah, I'd feel the same way if she wrote it. You felt, but my wife, I'm telling you, does not feel that way about me. I'm very fortunate to report, you know, I've been a monogamous guy for 25 years. I'm pretty sure she's been a monogamous woman, but, and I'm not patting myself on the back. And I, by the way, don't judge people who stray. We all have our path. We all learn what we have to learn. But it is an act of the imagination. It really is. So much of what's in there, you know, there's a lot of self-destructive behavior and hopefully, you know, slivers of hope here and there too. But you raise a good point. You know, when your mate, your lover, your partner goes into the dream world and pulls up all this naked stuff, you start to wonder literally, so how'd you know that?
Why did I miss this?
Yeah.
And why didn't I see this this sooner? And in many cases in cheating where there's that other, where you have a completely other life, and how are you duplicitous without the other person knowing?
Yeah, one of the things that I found interesting in discovering in that big infidelity story, the first one, is it's just how much a role our day lives have when we work, when we come home. And, you know, the fact that he's a project manager, which is a very controlling job, and when he comes home, he actually controls his wife far more than he ever thought he did.
Mm.
You know, has a real hand in alienating her from him. And that's just part of our lives. We drift, and especially when you've got two careers and you spend all day long with other people. You know, and by the way, the best hours of your day, when you have the most energy, the most cheerful, you're not just grumblingly getting out of bed and heading off, and you're not just going to bed tired. You know, we save those parts of the day for our partners, and they get the lousiest part of us. They get the distracted, stressed one in the morning, and they get the tired, stressed one at night. And it's amazing we have any kind of relationship at all.
Andre DeBuse III is the author of the new collection, Dirty Love. I'm hoping you can read from one of my favorite stories in the book, which is The Bartender.
Sure. I'm just going to read a brief passage. Robert Doucet is married to Althea. She's pregnant. He's a bartender. It's set on Hampton Beach, New Hampshire. On days with no sea breeze, the cabin filled with the smell of sewage from the marsh, and Althea would usually feel nauseated, and they would leave for a walk down the boulevard, which was almost worse with its canned rap and rock blaring from the shops, the sidewalks crowded with sun-beaten tourists, the smells of fried dough and teriyaki steak from the fryer laters and grills, the roar of a Harley-Davidson out on the street, a gang of seagulls shrieking from above. Althea would squeeze his hand, holding her protruding belly with the other, and soon Robert and his wife would have to go into a restaurant for a bathroom where she might throw up, and Robert would sneak a quick tequila shot or two at the bar while he ordered two Cokes, one to hide the tequila, a fiery friend and confidant in his gut, the other for her. They would sit in a booth or at a small table in the shadows away from the bright street, and she would sip her Coke stoically, staring at the rug or sometimes just at Robert's hand or chest, which left him feeling she was a bit simple, taking her pain in an unquestioning and almost bovine way. He would think of the heifers on his father's dairy farm, the vague indifference in their eyes as his father loaded the breeding gun with thawed bull semen, his entire arm covered with a lubricated plastic sleeve. But other times, the surreptitious tequila shots spreading out in his belly like a purging grass fire, Robert would feel moved at her silent suffering, and he would lean over and give and kiss her clammy hand, this pregnant woman he was beginning to bronze in a maternal cast only.
Andre DeBuse III, reading from story The Bartender in Dirty Love, published by Norton. You said a moment ago that you seldom use the word pride in looking back at your work. At what point is there a sense of pride in writing a particular sentence? There's some beautiful writing in just what you read.
No, thank you. I'm very wary of the word pride, because there's a sense for me that when I'm writing well, that I'm tapping into something, that I'm finding something, that the writing is larger than I am, and it's allowed me in. And so to all of a sudden turn that around and pat myself on the back for having done it feels counterintuitive and against what just happened. So does that make sense? To me,
it does.
To me, this whole notion of creating art, or at least...
It's also very Irish.
Yeah, it's very, yeah. You know, I've got a French name, but I'm three quarters Irish there, Joe. And maybe there's like,
I know it well.
Maybe there's guilt, shame. I don't. I cannot take too much credit. But the, yeah, well, here's the real Irish part. But if you trash that book, I'll take total blame for it not being any good.
Yeah.
So it's not like you say, oh, I had nothing to do with it. But I do. I do take satisfaction in writing a sentence. And of course, you rewrite it 100 times sometimes, often, where you feel like, you know, I think I may have captured that moment. And it that is deeply satisfying. And frankly, it's that's one of the reasons why I write in the first place at all. But, well, on the micro level, on the macro level, you write enough of those true sentences where you feel you've captured the experience of the character, you're going to go into that character and capture something thematic about our time, maybe, or, you know, something much larger than that one person. Mm-hmm. And that is deeply satisfying. And that's really why I write, to get to those moments of discovery where you think, man, I may have captured what it's like to be a father in 2013. And, you know, that's, you know, I'm never sure I have, but you start to get the sensation that you're in true waters, and that's really a thrill, really.
I was going to say one of my favorite stories, and I really, I enjoyed all of these stories. But Marla, I think, is one that stuck with me for a while. There's something there about that character that is troubling and so true that it sticks with you. How did you come? You spoke a moment ago about how suddenly she appeared, yeah. And then you were off to the races.
Well, you know what's so weird about it all. I was visiting my sister, Suzanne, down in Miami about 25 years ago. And she was working in a bank. We were both in our early 20s. And I was walking, it was summer in Miami, and I was walking across a baking hot asphalt parking lot of a bank. And I just glance at the drive-through window, which is just this air-conditioned little glass bulb that one woman was sitting in, this bubble. And I glanced at her for maybe half a second, and I kept walking into the bank. And she was large, kind of pretty, and she looked so solitary in that bubble. And 20-something years later, she shows up under my pencil in this story, Marla. And I know it came from that half second I glanced at a stranger working a drive-through. And I just could feel her solitary, well, and it wasn't just solitude, it was loneliness in the solitude. And I started to write myself in, and I realized I was writing about a lot of women and men I've met over the years, far more than you would have, that I think a lot of us imagine, who kind of miss that love train. They don't get on it. They haven't made love. They go deep into they're still in their adulthood, and they have not even had a sexual life. And I found that I cared about her far more than, you know, again, the predator whose point of view I wanted to write from. And I just jettisoned him and went with her. And I found this woman who, when she does find love, realizes that's where the true. Now that she's a member of a couple, which is something she always craved, now, you know, deeper challenges present themselves.
The title story is Dirty Love. And again, very much you're exploring sexuality.
Yeah. That one's told from two points of view. It's the longest one in the book, as you know, about 150 pages, and it's told from the point of view of 18-year-old Devin, who's fleeing a pornographic, short film of her that boys have put online against her will. And she's living with the only man she's ever felt really loved by, and that's her 81-year-old great-uncle Francis, her father's uncle, who is a recovering alcoholic and Korean War veteran and newly widowed, living alone. And I was really, you know, that one began with, I could just sense, it was, you know, it's very intuitive, this creative writing stuff, right? I could just sense a young woman, girl/woman, and an old man. And I sensed they both loved each other very much, and it was very healthy, but they were in a house together, and I wasn't sure why. And then they revealed themselves. But you're right, sex comes up a lot. Devin's in this kind of pornographic age where I think girls are being objectified more than ever, and I think it has to do, frankly, with the internet. And he's from his generation, man. He's from the 40s and has a whole different view of women and girls and boys and what marriage is supposed to be. Yeah, I really enjoyed exploring those two together. And I, again, there's no pride in what I write, but I was relieved to find so much healthy love in that story. I think there's a lot of good tenderness in that story.
There certainly is. And when you see the older perspective, it's not as if it is, oh, the good old days.
Yeah, he's not romanticizing anything. In fact, he's, you know, he was traumatized in war as a 19-year-old. He witnessed a massacre based entirely on fact, by the way. And he carried that demons into the States, where he became a really heavy drinking alcoholic. Until around age 53, he stopped. So, and his own marriage to his wife was not perfect, as none are. And he feels guilty, in fact, that even though he mourns the loss of his wife of 43 years, there's a part of him relieved to be free of her daily nagging, and he feels great guilt about this. And of course, he'll never tell anybody that. So he's a complicated guy, and he lives in a complicated time. And I really enjoyed trying to see if those two could ever find a way to communicate over that chasm generationally. I don't know if they ever do, but they love each other anyway.
Mm. And even an understanding of technology and the world we're in.
Yeah, because Devin, one of the things she does, as you know, is she gets on Chat Roulette every night as a way to sort of... I wasn't sure why she was getting on Chat Roulette every night, seeing she was sort of brutalized by the internet. But it's her way to get her power back. She'll press a button and there'll be some strange man in a foreign country or faraway state, and she'll just stare at him and give him nothing while he wants something. It's usually sexual.
When you complete something like this, are you, what's next? Are you thinking novel? Or are you thinking?
No, I mean, I'm deep into a novel. I think it's the longer form seems to be my more natural inclination creatively. And, I finished writing a screenplay, too, though, an original screenplay based on an inmate in the mass system. It's a very interesting, real, true-life story called The Citizen, but I worked on that for years. But I've got both feet into a novel. I'm about 4 months in, and the cells are multiplying and dividing, and I'm just trying to keep a dark lid on it and let it go where it wants to go, and already it's scaring the hell out of me. You know, honestly, I'm writing about something I don't even want to write about again.
What are the advantages for you as a writer to keep the dark lid on it?
Well, many. And I actually talk to young writers and try to advise them to try to do that. Here's the problem, especially if you're in graduate school. If you're in an MFA program, and I taught in one for 9 years and I traveled to a lot of them, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to talk about when you're drinking beer at the end of the day with your colleagues? You tend to talk about what you're working on. And to me... it's a mistake, at least for me. And I think it may be a mistake for people who don't think it might be. To me, it's like masturbating before making love. Why would you do that? You want to keep that tension and bring it to the act. There, you need that tension of the untold. You need that story to be still not unfolded yet inside you, so that, you know, it's hard to show up at the desk for years at a time to write a long story, and you want to keep all that tension. And also... you know, look, you know, I think whether you're male or female, when you're writing a story, you're pregnant with that story. And the cells are multiplying and dividing inside the writer. And your job's just to get blood to the baby. Prematurely showing a draft to someone, and by the way, I think we usually do that for transparent reasons. We usually do it because we want people to tell us how great it is. But usually people aren't going to say that. And so I don't think it's helpful to cut open the mother and poke around and say, I don't know, people don't really like brown eyes anymore. You know, blue eyes are in now. It's not helpful to the baby. It's not helpful to the mother. So, man, I'll spend 4 or 5 years on a novel. My wife won't know one thing about it. I just never talk about it to anybody, even my editor, which frustrates her, but she allows it, and I'm grateful for that.
And it allows, I assume, for you a freedom that you're not nailed down to anything because you haven't committed yourself.
Yeah, all I've committed to is I'm going to write daily. And well, in this sense, I mean, it does get problematic when at the professional level you start to sign contracts and you owe a novel, because I've written many novels that have turned into short stories. So there's a bit of an issue there, Joe. That's when you just, you know, hold your breath and trust and dive in. It's going to be what it's going to be. But I'm telling you, I hope I never write a novel that doesn't want to be a novel just to fulfill a contract. And I haven't had to do that yet.
The new collection of novellas is Dirty Love. It is published by Norton. Andre DeBuse, it's a great pleasure to see you as always. Thank you.
You too, Joe. Thank you.
I want to thank you for joining us for The Book Show. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. The show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.